Beaver Creek 911, where is your emergency?
This is A Matter of Seconds, a documentary produced by WISO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. We're marking 1 year since John Crawford III was shot and killed by police inside a Walmart in Beaver Creek. I'm managing editor Lewis Wallace.
And I'm Community Voices producer Steve McQueen.
We'll be your hosts for this hour. In part one, we'll review the incidents at the Walmart and how police and prosecutors responded.
Then we'll look at the protest movement that grew out of it, how Black Lives Matter has become a national call, and what it means for organizers here in Ohio.
Finally, we'll take on proposed solutions at the local, state, and national level.
We ask community members what they've learned and what they hope will come next.
Coming up,
my question is, you know, at what point does someone's behavior justify murdering them?
We start on August 5th, 2015 in Beaver Creek, a suburb of Dayton.
More than 200 people gather outside the Walmart where John Crawford was killed and call out the names of people killed by police. Anthony Edgecombe from Columbus says he's tired.
Every time I turn on the TV and I see another brother dead, you know what I'm saying, I cry.
And it goes beyond the police shootings.
I'm all over the country. I'm tired of, you know, our neighborhoods being not maintained as well as the wealthy neighborhoods, our schools not having as good of teachers and things like that. I'm just tired of racism.
Demonstrators sing in a large circle and then carry a foam coffin down to the doors of the Walmart and stage a die-in. John Crawford's mother, Tressa Sherrod, stands to the side holding a bouquet of flowers. Walmart closed the store during the whole protest.
Black Lives Matter!
Meanwhile, over in Dayton...
Black Lives Matter! Not only here in Dayton, Ohio, Montgomery County and Greene County, but all over the state of Ohio, Cuyahoga County and Cleveland and St. Louis and Jefferson, Missouri, everywhere, Black Lives Matter.
About 100 people gathered in Courthouse Square downtown to rally and release dozens of balloons in honor of John Crawford III and his family. His father, John Crawford Jr., addressed the crowd.
We have an epidemic going around in the country where, for the most part, Black people are being targeted by unethical acts. We're going to continue to fight. We're not going to stop. It's not going to dissipate. They think it's going to die down. They think John Crawford, it's not going to die.
But this story starts more than a year ago. On August 5th, 2014, Lewis Wallace is going to walk us through it.
It was a warm Tuesday evening just before dusk. A 22-year-old father of two from Fairfield, near Cincinnati, stopped off at Walmart with his girlfriend to get ingredients for s'mores. They were headed to a cookout with friends in the Dayton area. Inside the store, John Crawford got on his cell phone to have a talk with the mother of his young kids, Lisi Johnson. The conversation got intense. While he was on the phone, Crawford distractedly picked up a BB gun sitting out on a shelf. Then, this phone call.
Beaver Creek 911, where's your emergency?
I'm at the Beaver Creek Walmart. There's a gentleman walking around with a gun in the store.
Is he got it pulled out?
Yeah, he's like pointing at people.
What does he look like?
He's a black male, probably about 6 foot tall.
The caller is Ronald Ritchie. He's a white man shopping at Walmart with his wife. Surveillance videos show Crawford by himself in the pet food aisle, still on the phone, with the pellet gun hanging at his side, the barrel pointed down. He doesn't seem aware of his surroundings. Within minutes, two white Beaver Creek officers rushed into the Walmart. In a matter of seconds after seeing him, Officer Sean Williams fired two shots at 22-year-old John Crawford III. The woman Crawford was on the phone with, Lisi Johnson, says she heard him cry out, "It's not real," in that final moment. An officer says John Crawford was handcuffed briefly before they realized he was bleeding profusely. Meanwhile, people were evacuated, including a 37-year-old woman from Fairborn named Angela Williams, who collapsed during the panic and later died because of a heart condition. John Crawford's girlfriend, Tasha Thomas, who'd been waiting for him outside, was taken to the Beaver Creek Police Station and interrogated. Their video release later shows she was in tears for much of the questioning.
I don't understand that, yes, sir.
Okay, tell me where he got the gun from.
Sir, I don't know. I honestly don't know.
And the truth is, you knew at some point he did carry a gun, isn't it?
No, sir, I didn't know. I swear I didn't know.
An officer pushes her to talk. Tasha insists she didn't see how John could have possibly had a gun. At the end of an hour and a half at the station, her interrogator comes back in to let her know Her young boyfriend has died at Miami Valley Hospital. Thomas sobs quietly as the video continues to roll. For people following the story, the first 24 hours after John Crawford's death were confusing. Beaver Creek police put out a statement suggesting they'd taken down an active shooter. Here's Police Chief Dennis Evers the next day.
The quick response of officers was instrumental in containing this situation, minimizing the risk to customers.
The Dayton Daily News ran an article referring to Crawford as a suspect. Beaver Creek police said they would hand the investigation over to the Attorney General's office, but continued to suggest that Crawford had been waving a gun inside the store. But his family went to the news to dispute that story. Within 48 hours, the Attorney General's office released a different story, that John Crawford was in fact holding an air rifle BB gun he'd likely picked up off the shelf. 2 days later, this.
In a suburb of St. Louis on Saturday afternoon, a police officer shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. His name was Michael Brown. He was 18
just as
old,
people became aware of what had happened to John Crawford, a national movement emerged. A couple weeks after both John Crawford and Michael Brown were killed, Antioch College students staged a walkout connecting John Crawford and Michael Brown's deaths with dozens of other police killings of black people around the country. WISO's Jerry Kenny was there.
Organizers of the national movement say the event coincided with the first day Michael Brown of Ferguson was scheduled to attend college. Instead, his funeral services were held today. Antioch College student Eric Rhodes helped get the word out about their event.
It's not just Ferguson that's hurting, and this problem doesn't really know sort of local borders. It's been a problem for a long time.
Sharice Francis, 30, March 15th, 2012.
Irvin Jefferson, 18, March 24th, 2012.
During the walkout, the names of more than 30 African Americans killed by police were read aloud. The list included the name of 22-year-old John Crawford, who was killed by police at a Beaver Creek Walmart earlier this month.
We're gathering here also to raise awareness around the John Crawford case, which we believe is in need of investigation on the federal level as well.
Organizers will continue their efforts on Wednesday morning when they say a protest will be held at the federal building in Dayton to call for the Federal Department of Justice to take up the investigation into the John Crawford case. Jerry Kenny, WYSO.
Eric Garner, 43, July 7, 2014.
Meanwhile, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine appointed a grand jury to investigate whether the officers should be indicted for any crime.
Mr. Crawford's parents have questions about how this tragic event unfolded. And I felt it was only right that they be included as early as possible in this investigation. We must remember that they are parents who have lost a son, and they do deserve answers.
And protests started to grow. First, a handful of people showed up outside the Greene County Courthouse in Xenia to demand the release of the Walmart surveillance video. Darshiel Sabi is a Beaver Creek resident and member of the Ohio Student Association, a statewide youth organization.
My question is, you know, at what point does someone's behavior justify murdering them?
Then in late September, this happened.
A Greene County grand jury decides not to indict the police officers who shot and killed a man inside the Beaver Creek Walmart.
The law says that the police officers are judged on what is in their mind at the time.
The Walmart surveillance video was released that same day, and rather than satisfy demonstrators, it made them even angrier. In the video, John Crawford wanders around Walmart on his cell phone for a long time. He's a normal-looking guy, blue jeans, black shirt. He appears distracted, and there's no sign that he interacts with anyone in the minutes leading up to his death. After officers get to the store, it appears to be a matter of seconds before he falls over. Police have repeatedly said they told John Crawford to put down the gun and that Officer Sean Williams shot him only after he didn't comply. Sergeant David Darkow, the other officer on the scene, later told investigators he would have shot if Williams hadn't first. But in the video, the whole thing happens so quickly. The officers come around the corner into the pet food aisle. Crawford looks surprised and falls over. Some activists who've analyzed the surveillance video say John Crawford only had 3/5 of a second to respond. Police suggest there was more time. This matter of seconds and what went through the officers' minds during those seconds has become a symbol of just how polarized the whole discussion is. One person can watch the video and see police making a difficult decision. Another person can watch and see a cold-blooded murder. After the grand jury decision, the U.S. Department of Justice and the FBI said they'd review the case. Those results have yet to be released.
You're listening to A Matter of Seconds, a WYSO documentary on the year since John Crawford III was killed by police in Beaver Creek. I'm Steve McQueen.
And I'm Lewis Wallace. In part one, we've been reviewing the last year.
Now we look at the reaction from the community after officers were indicted. In October of 2014, the Ohio Student Association staged a sit-in at the Beaver Creek Police Station demanding to meet with the chief. WYSO's Jerry Kinney was there.
The group plans to ask Beaver Creek Police Chief Dennis Evers about three issues: consequences for Sean Williams and for Ronald Ritchie. The 911 caller, they say, lied to police when he said Crawford was waving a gun at people. Finally, they want to know if police will change their procedures or training.
We're not going to go away until we have answers, until someone is held to account for the death of John Crawford.
OSA member James Hayes says police have agreed to meet with the group Wednesday.
They've all been very cordial, so we take that as a good sign that we might be able to have productive conversations with them. But we understand that the whole reason we're at the table, the whole reason that we are being given this sort of treatment is because we've shown the willingness and capacity to move people and to tell this story wide and far, so we're not going to stop doing that.
WYSO's Jerry Kinney reporting. Officer Sean Williams was initially placed on paid leave. Now he's in a desk job until the federal investigation is over. In November, our Dayton Youth Radio Project took a look at the police shootings through the eyes of students at David H. Ponitz High School. All three of the students lived near the Beaver Creek Walmart, and the deaths of Michael Brown and John Crawford got them thinking. Here are Miles Harbison, Nadia Bush, and James Maddox Jr.
When I first heard about the Michael Brown and John Crawford III situation, I felt hurt and angry. I didn't know them, but I felt like I did because they were African American.
It made me realize that black men still get judged by the color of the skin today, and not that much has changed since the Trayvon Martin situation.
I felt angry and distraught. It became more and more obvious to me that black men in today's world are still judged by the color of their skin. After giving our opinion, Nadia, Miles, and I decided to take it within the household by asking our loved ones how they feel when we go out in public with our friends.
I talked to my grandma and my mom, Vicky and Kimberly Tolliver, about dangers in our community. Here's my mom, Kimberly.
They talk about how bad it is over here, but I feel safe. You don't mess with nobody, they don't mess with you.
Here's my grandma, Vicky.
Police should have been more in an investigative mode instead of a trigger-happy mode by shooting those guys. I feel like they should have investigated a little bit more. I feel that I can trust the police to come out when I want them to, but our neighbors watch each other. We have a community or a neighborhood that look out for each other, so I trust my neighbors more than I do the police. Yes, it's dangerous out here, and the black man needs to be trained. The young men need to be have some sort of mentors or something to have them to learn how to act in the areas where they go, because the eye is always on them. If they portray themselves a certain way, that's the way they're going to be treated.
I talked to my mom, Danita Sani, about safety in the community.
I'm always stressed out about you walking around the neighborhood by yourself, especially late at night.
It's a lot of danger around in the neighborhood, more so now than it used to be. I don't have a problem if I have met your friends and I know them and I've met maybe like their parents. But when I have not met them, then that's where the issue lies, because I don't really know anything about them. So when you're going around with your cousin, yes, that's fine. He's family and I know your cousin. But when you're going out with your friends, I don't really know your friends because I've never really met them. Everybody is not your friend, and I, being an older person than you, have a different point of view on who might be your friend versus you might just, you know, not saying that you are not a good judge of character, but you're probably more able to say, okay, he's going to be my friend until he does something wrong, where I'm looking at it as a parent point of view, which is a little bit different. So that's why I say, yeah, I would like to know their parents before you start hanging out with them so I can know what they're all about.
And I interviewed my mother and my father, Deanna and Jamie Maddox. My question to them was, what is their biggest fear when I go out in public with my friends? Here's Deanna with her opinion.
My biggest fear is that you are being stereotyped, that if you don't carry yourself in a manner that does not draw attention or that draws attention, what stereotype are you going to be linked under, you know? That if you're always carrying yourself in the manner that you're supposed to carry yourself in, then I don't worry about it. But I know when you are away from your parents, you do things differently. So that being said, I hope that you always are mindful of that.
And my biggest fear is that just hoping that you know to be mindful, and I guess I would say respect everybody else's, you know, rights outside of the home.
After sitting down and interviewing my parents, I learned that stereotyping is one of today's biggest problems with African American children.
After talking to my grandma and my mom, I realized that it's dangerous today for black men in America.
After sitting down with my mother, I realized that times aren't how they used to be, and you get judged everywhere you go, and not everyone is your friend.
That was Ponet students Nadia Bush, Miles Harbison, and James Maddox Jr. with Dayton Youth Radio. They produced the story with the help of WYSO Community Voices producer Basine Blunt and Ponet's media teacher Joanne Visco. I'm your co-host Steve McQueen.
And I'm Lewis Wallace. That story aired in November 2014. In December, Crawford's parents filed suit against the city of Beaver Creek, the individual officers, and the Walmart Corporation. Here's Richard Schulte, one of the lawyers, at that press conference.
We haven't had complete transparency from the police department or Walmart, okay? And we're going to expose what they've done, and we're going to share that information with the world.
None of the parties being sued are commenting while the legal case is still open. Later in December, we covered another series of demonstrations, this time a die-in at the Beaver Creek Walmart that led to several arrests. Here's WYSO's Wayne Baker.
After the die-in, demonstrators hung around in the parking lot until they were dispersed by police. Reverend Jerome McCory of Dayton spoke to the crowd.
These kinds of actions will happen continuously until justice is done. I think that it is important, especially during this Christmas season, that we do matter, that we do count, and there's no better way than to show it in folks' pocketbooks.
Beaver Creek police had no comment, and Walmart management says people were evacuated for safety and security reasons. Some shoppers were upset, while others were sympathetic to the demonstrators.
I think it's a wonderful thing, you know, because someone lied and someone died, and it's good that people are coming together for that. It needs to be justice.
There's been multiple black guys that shot white kids. You don't see us white people standing there saying, hey, where's our rights? You don't see that. We hardworking people work Monday through Friday, so we come out on Saturday. Now they close the store down for this. Go somewhere else.
I am being arrested.
That's Sandy King of Yellow Springs, who was arrested during a verbal interaction with police. King, Elias Kelly, Benjamin Vernston, and Matthew Roska have all been charged with misdemeanor trespass and obstructing official business. King was also charged with resisting arrest, a misdemeanor. All have been released on bond and are expected to appear in court December 26th.
WYSO's Wayne Baker.
On January 1st, 2015, there was even more tragic news. John Crawford's girlfriend, Tasha Thomas, died in a car crash. The driver of the car, a friend of hers, was going 100 miles per hour on a residential street.
The demonstrations kept growing. Over the winter, a group that became Miami Valley Black Lives Matter joined with the Ohio Student Association to protest at the federal courthouse several times. Then in April, members of the same group were kicked out of a Beaver Creek City Council meeting. Lewis Wallace was there.
A group of about 20 went inside the city council unexpectedly. Dayton resident Ndidi Achebe joined.
I think it's important that we keep present regarding John Crawford III and all of the other black and brown people who are being murdered on a regular basis by police.
The most recent development in the case is that a local review board found no police wrongdoing. Those results were released quietly in March. As Mayor Brian Jarvis begins the meeting, demonstrators interrupt.
Justice for John. Did you hear what we said? Young John Crawford should not.
They're all kicked out. Afterwards, the doors are locked. Back inside, one Beaver Creek resident, Danny Boehm, says he doesn't think this is the time or place.
It seems to me it's wearing a little thin. Everybody's aware of the situation, and we're all human. We all make mistakes.
Beaver Creek police, as well as the mayor, declined to be recorded, but police said the protesters were removed from the meeting because they caused a disruption. Lewis Wallace, WYSO.
You're listening to A Matter of Seconds, a documentary produced by WYSO in Yellow Springs 1 year after the death of John Crawford III. I'm Community Voices producer Stephen Queen.
And I'm managing editor Lewis Wallace. John Crawford was shot and killed August 5th, 2014 by police inside a Beaver Creek Walmart.
In part two of this hour, we look at Black Lives Matter, the local movement, and its national context. Coming up.
I had to ask myself a question. Do I want to get on the TSA's no-fly list?
Lots of people's lives were changed this last year, including the protesters who were arrested. The most widely publicized arrests were a Christmas Eve demonstration at the Fairfield Commons Mall. Steve McQueen put together this profile of Julius Eason, Maya Thornton Hodge, and Nancy Epling, who were all there.
Black lives matter!
Black lives matter!
They were reading these things, these pieces of paper. It was some kind of like code that we were breaking or whatever, like, you must leave the mall, we're asking you to leave now, you're trespassing, blah, blah, blah. If you do not leave, we're going to arrest you.
You will be criminally trespassed. You will not leave, you are now violating.
First, I'd like for each of you to just tell me your name.
Julius Eason.
Maya Celeste Thornton Hodge.
And I'm Nancy Epling.
The whole process was just like this arrest farm. The man that arrested me wasn't the guy that took me away. Wasn't the guy that wrote my ticket. Wasn't the guy that put me in the van. You know, so like
it was like set up like station by station.
Yeah,
like, all right.
They all had like 200 little zip ties hanging from their hips. So yeah, there was a clear intent there.
That's something that really keeps everybody through is that song element, and I love that.
That was one thing we didn't forget. That was very key to our survival, was singing songs together. Absolutely. At a lot of different steps of the process. I was, like, freaked out, and I was like, I gotta tell all my jobs this because I work with children and I work with a lot of people, and I was like, okay, is this gonna affect my job? So I was really worried about that, but it didn't, thank God.
It's sad because it's like once we were in the system and there's this element of already being defeated. Like, there's no choices. Like, you're either paying with your money or you're paying with your time.
Keep on talking, marching on the freedom land.
You've been arraigned. They have told you what you've been charged with. Now it is on to the pretrial.
Honestly, it's like we did not have to be there. No, so we went there, and it was so anticlimactic because we were so nervous. We hyped ourselves up. We're like, are we going to go to jail? What's going to happen?
We were all dressed nice.
Yeah. What? Like, I put some lipstick on in the morning. That's fine, because that's good. But
it was very anticlimactic.
Obviously, like, the plea deal sounded like the best option, but I was just trying to figure out, you know, how we might be able to fight it. Even if we took the plea, like, can we argue it down to, like a minor misdemeanor? Like, instead of trespassing, can we just get, like, disorderly conduct, you know?
I did not feel justified at all walking out of there. You know, I felt like I had to swallow the bureaucratic bowl, but I also would, of course, do it again because there was nothing that I felt like I did wrong. I still don't feel like a criminal in any way. I was charged with trespassing, but that was a heartbeat, and that could have been anybody in that situation just trying to fight for what they believe in. I would do it again.
What justice is there? Like, it's just feeding into the system. Like, people that get stuck in the loopholes, too. It's like it just keeps on going. It's never going to stop unless something has changed. And so that's my feelings. Yeah, I'd get arrested again in a heartbeat.
Hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
If anything, I'm even more committed to this. We just need to always, like, be on the streets. We just need to be pushing
trespass
that much more. We need to trespass that much more because, like, whose sense of justice are we trying to uphold here? You know? Obviously not theirs. And our sense of justice isn't being upheld here. And that's the problem. You know? Law and order doesn't apply to us. You know, we're dealing with, like, these white supremacist structures. You know, it's not just about police. You know, it's so much more than that. We do what we can so that we can live to fight another day because there's so much more work to be done.
Freedom side. What side are you on, my people? What side are you on?
Nancy Epling, Maya Celeste Thornton Hodge, and Julius Eason all pled guilty to trespassing in exchange for dropping an obstruction of justice charge.
Beaver Creek Police declined to comment for this story.
Another person who was arrested that night was Danny West. She has been a community organizer since she was 14.
It was coming up on holiday season, and I was coming back to visit my parents. I'm from the 937. I was raised in Washington Township. I went to Centerville City Schools.
She is a native of Ohio, but now she lives in Oakland, California. She was involved in protests out there when Oscar Grant was killed by police in 2009. And she immediately noticed the similarities between the situations.
The city of Oakland, after Oscar Grant was murdered, was a tangibly different place, you know? And, like, the city of Beaver Creek, this, you know, the Fairfield Commons, after John Crawford has been murdered by the police, it's a tangibly different place.
And she believes the demands of the community should go beyond the issue of police brutality.
There should be community reparations anyway. Like, if it's a context wherein somebody can just get up and killed in a Walmart, you know that, like microaggressions is even too small of a word. You know, like, there's just outright violence all day, every day. And so, like, from that perspective, we understand that, like, drastic accountability measures need taken. You know, and so, like, the conversation shouldn't even be on a we're going to charge these people. It should be on a, like, what does systemic reparations look like?
Danny West also says she's had a different experience of being arrested in Beaver Creek because she's a transgendered woman.
You know, and so then they take me and they process me and then they're all, let me ask you again, what is your gender? Female. Okay, well, I have a feeling we're about to charge you with felony fraud. You know, are you lying to us? Sir, are you lying to us? You know?
I talked to another Ohio native, Elle Hearns, who worked with Get Equal and Black Lives Matter about the importance of trans women in the movement.
To Black Lives Matter being a movement, Black trans women were organizing around the murders of Black trans women.
By the end of July, 11 trans women have been murdered in 2015. More than half of them were Black. Elle Hearns says the real problem is how Black trans people are treated in the judicial system as a whole.
There is no expectation that charges will be filed. And so when we are notified that charges were not filed, we are not alarmed because that is what is expected. But I don't think that folks actually want to fix, like, what's the root of all of these issues, which is systemic and structural racism, and also, transphobia and rampant homophobia within judicial spaces.
But I noticed the media has portrayed the police brutality issue as a Black male versus white officer issue. So I wondered about Black Lives Matter. It was founded by three women more than 2 years ago after George Zimmerman was acquitted in the Trayvon Martin case. Do you find that it's male-centered?
I think that Black Lives Matter actually has done a remarkable job. And I think what's really important to note is that there is hashtag Black Lives Matter, and then there's a lot of rogue Black Lives Matter organizing that's happening. So that rogue Black Lives Matter organizing that's happening isn't really reflective of the three co-founders of Black Lives Matter and their chapter's efforts towards really highlighting the injustices that all Black people are facing, especially those who are most marginalized. I think it's important to just continue to lift up the name of John Crawford. I think that that's really, really important. I think part of what my work really is about is just making sure that we are no longer honoring people in death, and also making sure that we are remembering people's names who have sacrificed everything so that we can continue to fight.
That's Elle Hearns, a Columbus-based organizer with Get Equal and Black Lives Matter.
I'm Steve McQueen.
And I'm Lewis Wallace. This is A Matter of Seconds, a documentary about the year since John Crawford was shot by police inside a Beaver Creek Walmart. We're looking at the Black Lives Matter movement in Ohio, how it's grown and changed. I talked to somebody who sees this movement not as 2 or 10 years old, but actually hundreds of years.
The slave trade rested on a belief that people of African descent were either not human or another strain of humanity.
This is Kevin Magruder, associate professor of history at Antioch College. He says he sees a historical precedent for Black Lives Matter in abolitionist activism from the 1700s. Back then, the Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade created an emblem.
A Black man kneeling, almost with his hands in prayer, kind of looking up, and it's surrounded by lettering that asks the question, am I not a man and a brother?
The idea was to humanize slaves, to show that they were people whose lives mattered. Magruder thinks civil rights activists used some of these same tactics.
They're not using the exact language of the 1780s, but they're definitely drawing on those images of Black humanity.
And some of the struggles are the same today. He says that legacy of slavery is still with us.
We live in a nation which is founded on Black lives not mattering. And the laws supported that for hundreds of years. But even as those laws were rolled back, our practices have continued to support that.
He includes police shootings of unarmed Black people in those practices. Magruder says he watched the video of John Crawford, and he thinks Crawford was treated as less than human.
And so that's question, am I not a man and a brother? You know, you could say if he had an opportunity to ask that question, that's what he might have been asking. As he was wondering, why is he shot and bleeding to death on that floor? And
Magruder says Black Lives Matter is an echo of am I not a man and a brother? But today, it's not a question anymore. It's a statement.
I think it's genius. Because you can't refute it.
That's Antioch College history professor Kevin Magruder. I'm Lewis Wallace.
And I'm Steve McQueen.
We're looking at how Black Lives Matter has taken off in Ohio.
People are talking and debating about it all over. Lewis found that it's even going on at church.
So I learned this pastor, K. Edwin Bryant, is doing a Black Lives Matter Bible study at Mount Pisgah, a church on the northeast side of Dayton. I went to hear one of his sermons. It's a Wednesday evening, and he's addressing a large room about the concept of loving your neighbor.
To say you love God and you do not love your neighbor is a contradiction.
Even, he says, when you're dealing with everyday racism. He gives the example of his own recent experience of flying first class.
I was standing in line with my ticket. Clearly, I was in line waiting to get on the plane. And a white gentleman walked right past me, got in front of me, and assumed that I wasn't flying. I had to ask myself a question. Do I want to get on the TSA's no-fly list? Or how do I respond?
Pastor Bryant says he tried to tap into his sense of ethical love and just politely let the man know he was in line. But in a conversation before his sermon, Pastor Bryant says, sure, dealing with racism all the time can lead to bottled up anger. He says he got the idea for a Black Lives Matter Bible study after the news about 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was killed by Cleveland police last fall. It was on everyone's mind anyway.
And I just stopped Bible study and I raised the question, you know, how do you feel?
People talked about rage and sadness. He says he's trying to lead his congregation from anger to action.
Anger unchecked and rage that's uncritical leads to destruction and the loss of life or even loss of property. So, you know, that's not the response. The response we want is something that changes legislation, something that changes the sentiment of community as a whole.
Toward the end of our talk, I find out Pastor Bryant actually lives in Beaver Creek, where John Crawford was shot and killed. And just like a lot of Black parents, he's had to talk to his own young sons about not playing in their yard with toy guns. He tells them,
unfortunately, you are unable to have that same privilege.
As a pastor and a Beaver Creek resident, Bryant is dismayed that the city has held no vigil, given no recognition for John Crawford's death. He wants to see the police and the city simply apologize.
In a situation like this, it needs to be public. It needs to be available. It needs to be something that's visible, something that is heard or placed on an ad placed on the stations for which the people affected listen to. That I have not heard or seen or witnessed.
Before I leave Mount Pisgah Church, I talk to Robin Boozer at the Bible study and ask her what she thinks about Black Lives Matter.
It's bad that you even have to say that, first off. It's bad that you even have to say Black Lives Matter. And not only, and then ours is all Black Lives Matter. But all lives matter, you know, but it's not, being Black in America, you don't feel like you matter.
Written on December 3rd, the day after the Eric Garner verdict. I have no poem for today, just a bowl of persimmons ripening on our kitchen counter and some photocopied handbills, hashtag justice for John Crawford, trapped beneath the refrigerator magnet next to the to-do list. We get to every vigil late, or not at all, because the act of living daily insists on interfering. That's what injustice needs, right? The act of living transformed into a quotidian distraction. I want to be Maya-esque, wordsmith healing, and craft a crisp phrase for you to carry in your pocket. Certainly you, like me, are angry, grieved, vexed, numb. We're searching for the words that will make any of this seem better. But I have no poem for today. I just have breath. Just breathing. If my breath could travel across time, I'd whisper. No, I'd yell this message to our great-great-grandbabies. Know who you are. Listen to my voice. I've been speaking to you for 100 years before your conception. Know who you are. Kiss your own palms and send love coursing directly to your own heart, babies. Know who you are. You come from people who could fly, whose dreams manifest as music. Babies, know who you are. You come from people whose love binds them to the daily act of breathing. Breathe, babies. Breathe, babies. Breathe freely. Thank you.
Faraha Henry Jones is a professor and a parent who lives in Centerville. We recorded this at a Black Lives Matter poetry slam in Yellow Springs.
This is A Matter of Seconds, a documentary produced by WYSO in Yellow Springs 1 year after John Crawford's death in the Dayton suburb of Beaver Creek. I'm Community Voices producer Steve McQueen.
And I'm managing editor Lewis Wallace. John Crawford was shot by police just 4 days before Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri. And as we've heard this hour, a movement took off in Ohio and around the country. Now we're looking at proposed solutions.
One of the problems identified by activists and journalists around the country has been a lack of good data on police use of force.
What data does exist suggests a racial disparity. A local group called Over the Blue Wall has been advocating for a statewide database on police killings. Kelly Wood is a co-founder.
We're just trying to get facts. So that's really the important part.
Earlier this year, Governor John Kasich's Community Police Advisory Board recommended the creation of a statewide database, and now it is in the works, though it's not clear yet exactly how use of force will be defined.
In the Crawford case and other police shootings, attention has been focused on the grand jury process. Some legislators have called for reform or alternate measures. YSO's Jerry Kinney talked to Lori E. Shaw, a professor of lawyering skills at the University of Dayton School of Law, to learn more about the process.
You followed the Crawford case as it went through the grand jury process, correct?
Yes.
Was there anything that stood out to you as out of the ordinary or improper?
I did not see anything that was improper. Actually, the process was far more transparent than a normal grand jury proceeding is. There are grand jury proceedings every day, and typically the results are only shared with the court. Either the grand jury indicts someone, or they decline to indict someone, in which case they send to the court what they call a no true bill, saying there's no reason to indict this person. In this instance, at the conclusion of the grand jury proceeding, the special prosecutor actually provided a lot of detail and a lot of materials about what happened, and that's highly unusual in grand juries.
Critics of the grand jury process say they're too secretive, and by not being open to the public, there's a certain amount of mistrust that's generated. Is that mistrust misplaced?
I think it is misplaced. One reason goes to preventing oftentimes the potential defendant from finding out about it. If a potential defendant knows that he or she is being investigated by a grand jury, a couple of bad things could happen. They could flee the country or flee the jurisdiction, or they could try to influence witnesses.
There are a number of reforms being called for, including one Ohio State senator calling for the abolishment of the grand jury process altogether. What are your thoughts there?
Now, I've seen some proposals that were interesting where I think that there's one in Congress where they're talking about saying, well, we're going to do it, but only for police officers, only in cases where a police officer's use of deadly force is being investigated. The issue you're going to have with that is, I think, there are incredibly strong constitutional arguments that you can't take someone's rights as a citizen away because they're a police officer. In other words, you can't say, again, unless the Constitution is amended, that this person who happens to be a police officer doesn't have the right to go through the grand jury process. So is it possible? Yes, but I think it would likely take a constitutional amendment to do that.
That was Jerry Kenney talking with Professor Lori Shaw about the grand jury process. You're listening to A Matter of Seconds, a documentary on the year since John Crawford was killed. I'm Lewis Wallace. In addition to grand jury reform, many are advocating police reform. They say police need better training, more awareness of race and diversity, and some are just generally concerned about too much policing, racial profiling, and mass incarceration. Steve McQueen recorded a conversation between a police chief and someone who wants the system to change.
I was able to sit down with Stephen Hunt and Chief David Hale of the Yellow Springs Police Department. Stephen Hunt is a man of color who is a kitchen manager, but until last year, he was actively seeking to become a police officer himself. Right now, he is on pause.
So let me just get a little mic check on you guys.
Check.
Yeah.
check.
Chief Hale is brand new to Yellow Springs. He was with the Montgomery County Sheriff's Department for 30 years. We start by talking about recent events in the media involving the police.
I believe clearly there are mistakes by police departments, by police officers. There are tragedies that occur that involve police officers. But the media has definitely found that when they air these things, that they get a large response.
Stephen Hunt explains his earlier doubts about becoming an officer.
You know, you hear all these stories about, negative stories about police officers and you know, corruption and this and that. And I would have found myself, I felt, in a position to where I was either getting fired for conflicts with fellow officers, just based upon my mentality. I'm very stubborn. And or, you know, I'd get fired for not feeling that this person needed to be arrested for this, and maybe technically I should have.
And now we're getting to the nitty-gritty, racial issues.
A lot of Black America has their concerns and are scared of the police. And I've had people tell me, you know, that they are teaching their kids to be scared of the police, or that they're worried about the police. And one of my concerns is that if I, as a white officer, have a legitimate reason to stop four young men of color, and I walk up to them, and they're scared of me, and I'm coming in as an authority figure, how they react being scared may be interpreted by me as a white officer as them being defiant or even aggressive. So what you end up with then is you have an authoritative guy who's taught to always control the situation approaching four guys who are now scared, who don't mean to, but are technically being perceived as aggressive. Well, when that happens, the probability of something digressing and going downhill, I mean, goes way, way up.
So I asked Stephen whether he believes, as a person of color, he could make others feel more comfortable around police officers.
My father being Black, my mother being white, my skin tone isn't quite as dark. I don't know if my presence, just because of, I mean, people look at me not as Black necessarily, not as white. I mostly just get a, I'm curious, what are you?
But Steve goes on to explain that he's not sure his race or being a good person would make a difference anyway.
To me, especially being in a small town, in a small department, you know, I know I'm acquainted with a lot of the officers here, good people. I see them as people. It's the system that I have issue with. And to place myself into the system that I have an inherent conflict with, especially in light of these national incidents and these killings, that's a huge reason that I just can't ignore, being a person of color. So,
and I respect that, but I mean, if you want to change things, you have two ways of doing it, from the inside, right, or the outside. I would encourage people who are willing to take the challenge on, especially young men of color, young women of color, to go for it. If this is your drive to do it, you continue to do it, and so that, you know, you may have some personal and moral conflicts with them, you're still going to go do what you do. So, and I encourage anybody to do that that's willing.
And under that pretext, that's why I put it on pause.
That was Community Voices producer Steve McQueen's conversation with Yellow Springs resident Stephen Hunt and police chief Dave Hale. Diversity is definitely lacking in local law enforcement. Just for example, in Yellow Springs, where Hale is chief, the force is 100% white. In Dayton, the force is 9% Black, in a city that's 42% Black, and across the state, 100% of county prosecutors are white. Changes are probably coming to police forces in the state. Professors, police, lawmakers, and pastors all took part in Governor John Kasich's task force on the issue. Cleveland State University professor Dr. Ronnie Dunn was on that task force and now sits on the Ohio Collaborative Community Police Advisory Board. WISO's Ariel Van Cleve talked to Dr. Dunn about what changes he'd like to see in Ohio.
One of the things that you had mentioned that I thought was really interesting was the idea of anti-profiling legislation. What would that look like in the state of Ohio? Is there another state that has something similar that we can use as a model if we were to go in that direction?
Actually, Ohio is in the minority of states without such legislation. We're one of 20 states that does not have some type of anti-profiling or biased policing legislation on its books. The state of Connecticut and Texas have a very robust anti-profiling ordinances on their books. And basically, that legislation would do two things. It would, one, prohibit the use of race, ethnicity, or some other type of social identifier or variable as the primary means of, in general, traffic stops. And secondly, the legislation would entail the required collection of demographic data on all involuntary contacts with law enforcement.
One of the other things that I thought was really interesting in some of the recommendations that you made specifically was the cultural competency training. And if that's already used by officers and by departments in the state, what struck me the most is the fact that you are talking about the quality of that training, not just the fact that we should require it. How will that improve what officers are already doing now?
I don't know that it's mandatory. A lot of departments do provide cultural competency training, but a lot of them don't feel they have diversity-related issues just because they might have a racially homogenous population in their community. But the thing is, we know that jurisdictions' boundaries are porous. So you, although your residential population might not be diverse, most localities would have diverse populations commuting through. So even with that and the training that they do have, I think this current crisis requires that we make sure we have the highest quality training that really has integrity and is authentic.
You mentioned the idea of, you know, the resistance to change. Maybe some departments not realizing that there are, you were saying, those porous borders. It seems like there's been sort of a slow process for a long time. People have been aware of these issues, but now it's at this point where it seems like a fever pitch.
Yes, absolutely. I think I state that we've reached a tipping point. I don't think that things will ever be able to just subside and regress and go back to the way things were in any location, any city or municipality is subject to have these the types of issues and unrest that we've witnessed. All it takes is one incident. And I argue that we're more likely to see an increase in these type of issues in that we're becoming a more racially and ethnically diverse society. The law enforcement police just represent the most ubiquitous agents of the government that the average citizen has contact with.
That's Cleveland State University Professor Ronnie Dunn talking with Ariel Van Cleve. Body cameras are another proposed reform.
And equipping officers with cameras is one of the recommendations from Governor John Kasich's task force.
But as WYSO's Ariel Van Cleve reports, a full rollout of body cams could take a while, and some are wondering if the move will only be a Band-Aid on a larger issue.
When people in law enforcement talk about body cameras, two words come up a lot: accountability and transparency. Officers like Beaver Creek Police Department Captain Eric Grile say having that footage means it'll be harder to question a specific event.
I have an audio-video recording of everything that corroborates the statement of the officer.
Though in certain cases, like the July 19th police shooting in Cincinnati, the body camera footage actually counters what the officer said happened. Ex-officer Ray Tensing told those in his department he was being dragged by 43-year-old Samuel DeBose's vehicle before he shot and killed DeBose.
No, he wasn't dragged.
That's Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters. He made that comment after looking at the tape from Tensing's body camera. Dieters says the footage made all the difference in this situation.
I think it's a good idea for police to wear that because, you know, 9 times out of 10, it clears them of wrongdoing. And in this case, obviously, it led to an indictment for murder.
Dieters will be able to use the video as evidence in the case. Almost all Cleveland police officers are wearing body cameras now, too. And Cleveland Police Detective Jennifer Chotch says officers have been responsive to wearing the cameras. Though just like with other aspects of their job, it takes repetitive training to get officers used to operating them.
It's more muscle memory than anything to have that thing on, and it's just one more thing you do every time you get out of the car. Coming from basic patrol, having spent 13 years on the road prior to this job, I can tell you, like, muscle memory is a huge part of what we do every day.
Cleveland has already spent around $2.5 million on the cameras and data storage. But not everyone thinks body cameras are the best way to go. Dr. Ronnie Dunn is a professor at Cleveland State University and a member of the Governor's Community Police Relations Advisory Board. He points to the case in New York with Eric Garner as a reason why he's apprehensive.
There was perfect video of that incident with audio. And, you know, he could be heard saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." And still, when that video was used in the grand jury process, there was not an indictment.
He's pushing for statewide legislation on racial profiling and required cultural competency training for officers. Reverend Linda Stampley of Springfield says she doesn't trust that each officer will always have the device turned on.
So if the body camera's turned off or if they're turned away from where the incident is happening, then it's no good. It's like the dashboard on the police car. Once you walk outside of that realm, you don't know what's going on.
Stampley's been taking part in protests over John Crawford's death since last year, and she says police involved in these types of incidents need to be punished in order to prevent more from happening. Stampley points out a grand jury didn't hand down an indictment for the officer who shot Crawford, even though there was footage recorded by a surveillance camera inside the Beaver Creek Walmart.
The officers that shot and killed John Crawford shot and killed him. It wasn't about having no cameras up above their heads or anything else. They just walked in and just gunned him down.
For now, the Beaver Creek Police Department is testing devices. Montgomery County and Dayton Police are also considering body cameras. And Dayton has applied for a grant through the U.S. Department of Justice to pay for the devices. These moves show it's not really an issue of if police will start wearing cameras, but when.
That was WYSO's Ariel Van Cleve.
This is a matter of seconds. We've been talking about solutions to the problem of police violence.
We asked a few people at these one-year anniversary events what they want to see happen.
Social programs, restorative justice, things like that.
Intercultural communication.
It's absolutely imperative that we continue to put pressure on the legal system, on the government, and on the community to not let this pass, not forget about this young man, and recognize this could be your child.
Police officers who witness other police officers doing wrong need to be prosecuted themselves.
What happened to John Crawford wasn't by accident. What happened to Eric Garner wasn't by accident. What happened to Trayvon Martin, for that matter, was not an accident. People may think it was, but in the big picture of things, no, it wasn't. This has been, again, in my opinion, brainwashing over decades, over centuries. We look at black skin, we assume they're dangerous, and it's just not the case.
That's Julius Eason, Vanita Kelly, Cheryl Smith, Mia Wortham-Spells, and Percy Vera.
We also asked John Crawford's father, John Crawford Jr., what he's learned.
We have an epidemic, a problem in our country with not only with racism, but within the confines of our justice system.
This year has been a turning point. People are scrutinizing police use of force more than ever before. At the time we're recording this, The Guardian US has counted 683 people killed by police so far in 2015, 19 in Ohio.
Black people were more than three times as likely than white people to be killed.
And we're hearing those names in the news. Samuel DeBose in Cincinnati, Rakia Boyd in Chicago,
Tamir Rice and Tanisha Anderson in Cleveland. Black Lives Matter has made a huge influence on what people all over the nation are thinking.
But in terms of actual policy and actual practice, not much has changed yet.
1 year after John Crawford died and Ferguson exploded, maybe this is just the beginning.
This is A Matter of Seconds. I'm Lewis Wallace.
And I'm Steve McQueen.
A Matter of Seconds was produced by Lewis Wallace, Steve McQueen, Jerry Kenny, Wasim Blunt, Ariel Van Cleve, Wayne Baker, and Nina Ellis at WYSO Public Radio in Yellow Springs. Special thanks for the music goes out to Faraha Henry Jones and G. Scott Jones.